This is Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In the next half hour, we'll talk to the parents of a North American woman who has been held in a Peruvian maximum security prison for over 2.5 years for her alleged involvement with one of the country's armed opposition groups. Rhoda and Mark Berenson continue to fight for their daughter's freedom and are now taking their campaign directly to the President of the United States. We'll hear what they have to say. Then we'll talk to the president of the National Indigenous Organization of Colombia, the ONIC, about last week's announcement by Occidental Petroleum that they'll not explore for oil in the ancestral lands of the Uwa Indians of northeast Colombia. Abadio Green-Stossel tells us that once again, Oxy is taking unilateral action without consulting with the indigenous leadership. Coming up next on Our Americas. Lori Helene Berenson is now in her third year of imprisonment in the Yanomamo Penitentiary in the highlands of Peru. She was arrested, charged, and convicted of terrorism by a faceless court in Peru back in 1995, accused of participating in a plot to attack the Peruvian Congress with the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, or the MRTA. At the time, her arrest and conviction drew attention to that country's repressive justice system, the faceless courts that were designed to combat so-called terrorism, but which have been criticized by human rights groups for jailing hundreds of innocent people who were involved in nothing more than social protest. 2.5 years have passed, and Lori Berenson's plight, like the thousands of other Peruvians who were languishing in Peru's horrendous jails, has been all but forgotten by the U.S. media. She continues to maintain her innocence while her parents continue trying to generate the international and national support to gain Lori's freedom. Now they're taking their campaign directly to President Clinton, who addressed the graduating class of MIT, Lori's school, on June 7th. Mark and Rhoda Berenson just returned from Peru, where they visited their daughter. They're now joining us from their home in New York City. Rhoda Berenson, to begin with, we'll start with you. Maybe you can tell us about your recent trip to Peru. You saw Lori. Can you tell us, how is she doing right now?
Well, amazingly, her spirits are still very good, very strong. It never ceases to amaze me how you can spend 23 hours a day inside a cell and still be determined to have as constructive a life as possible, reading, writing letters. She's still hoping, as we are, to resolve her situation either through a trial or through a release. She still feels that the system that arrested her is a horrible one, and she's looking to remedy that. She hopes that everyone here in the United States can help her. She called the system under which she was arrested and incarcerated, her words were despicable, inhumane, and illegal. And she still maintains her innocence. Health-wise, she's stable. And that's the best, which for us is better than deteriorating, at least at the moment. She's just come off of an unusually mild Andean summer. And winter is coming now, so we worry, and she worries, that things are going to get worse.
Mark, for our listeners who may not be familiar with the case of Lori Berenson, your daughter, why don't you tell us first of all what led up to her arrest and her detention, and then maybe we can talk a little bit about the conditions under which she is right now serving her prison sentence.
Lori is a freelance journalist and human rights activist that had worked in Central America, and then in her travels to South America fell in love with Peru and its peoples. She was there to study the Peruvian culture and had been studying Quechuan and learning about Peruvian music, but she was really there to observe the plight of the poor, because she had heard that President Fujimori had been president for a few years and that some people had said there had been progress and others had said there had been a greater schism between the haves and the has-nots, and she wanted to see what the impact had been on the Peruvian people. She was arrested coming off in a public bus after leaving the Congress on November 30th, 1995, and accused of treason and terrorism against the fatherland of Peru. She was convicted by a hooded judge with a gun pointed to her head. She never had due process. We didn't hire a lawyer for her until after she gave her public statement, her official statement, and she had no due process. She was never indicted. Peru violated many laws, which we are contesting at the Organization of American States and their Inter-American Human Rights Commission. And we also are contesting it at the Committee of Arbitrary Detention from the United Nations Human Rights Office in Geneva. So we have these two international cases going. Peru just rubber-stamped their conviction of her. It was a secret military tribunal, as I said, and she has always maintained her innocence. And even in the comment she told Rota last week, she said that to her mother that she had written a letter to Comandante saying that the system is, as Rota described it, despicable, inhumane, and illegal. In fact, she called it unconstitutional. And she says, "I am a prisoner of conscience, and I am innocent of absolutely preposterous charges, including the charge of being a member and leader of the MRTA, which he's not."
Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about it in the past. We haven't had you on in the last few months, but we have talked about the conditions under which she is imprisoned in Peru. Can you talk about that, and maybe that'll explain Roeder's comments about her being stable, which is better than deteriorating?
Well, the condition she lives in, she's an all-concrete cell, 23 hours a day and 1 hour a day in the sunlight. The Peruvian climate there, high in the Andes at 12,700 feet, that even in the warmest of weathers in the sunshine, in the summer there, it may reach 50 degrees, but depending on the summer, most of the times it's under 40 degrees Fahrenheit outside. Indoors, it's always colder, it's dark, there's no heat, there's no running water, there's no hot water. When she's given water in buckets in her cell. The toilet is simply a hole in the floor, so part of the water she's given is not only for drinking, but for cleaning herself, cleaning her body, washing down the waste and the hole in the floor. She sleeps on a mattress, and it's very austere. The window is in the hall facing her cell that has no window pane, so the Andes wind sweeps in. And so at night, the temperature can go down to 5 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit. She sleeps in 8 blankets with a winter coat on. Her face is always exposed. Her hands are gnarled and red and cut from the altitude and problems with oxygen in the high altitude for a person without indigenous blood. Chronic laryngitis for a year and a half now, unchecked. Her eyesight, time to time, had failed under the hostage crisis when she was in the dark most of 6 months. The crisis lasted 126 days, but they kept the cells dark for another month and a half to 2 months after that. The conditions are abominable, and that's why she says it's barbaric, it's inhumane, and she called it despicable. And it's not for herself. She says every Peruvian in the maximum security military prisons at Yanamayo, Chorrillos, and other parts of Peru, they're all the same. Discreto Ley 005. And she says that's what's unconstitutional, it's illegal, it's despicable. Those are the words she used to the Comandante. Those are the words she told the Peruvian government. And that's what it is. It's despicable, and it doesn't meet the standards of the United Nations on minimal treatment of prisoners.
We're speaking with Mark Berenson, along with Rota Berenson. They're the parents. They're both university professors here in the New York metropolitan area, and they're the parents of Laurie Helene Berenson, a North American journalist and activist who was imprisoned in Peru by the Fujimori government 2.5 years ago, and they're continuing their campaign to win the release of their daughter, and we just wanted to get an update on the situation. Now, there are a lot of activities taking place, and I know recently you had an op-ed piece published in the Boston Globe, and you were specifically focusing on the issue of the release of citizens imprisoned by foreign governments, which is a piece of legislation which you're kind of encouraging President Clinton to act upon vis-a-vis your daughter. Can one of you explain what that is and how that might affect the campaign around Laurie's release?
Well, what that is precisely is a congressional act, and it says, as you said, that the president is required by this act, by congressional law, to seek the release of an American citizen who is illegally imprisoned in a foreign country. And our efforts are focused on informing President Clinton and urging him to do what he is legally and morally expected to do. And that's why we wrote the op-ed article in the Boston Globe, because President Clinton gave the commencement address at MIT. MIT is Laurie School. MIT is a school that has supported Laurie's situation for these 2.5 years, and they, meaning the faculty, the administration, the students, the alumni, were behind us in trying to get a message to President Clinton that it's not enough to do, as he said to us 2 years ago, or said in a letter, that have his office closely monitor the situation. Monitoring how her health deteriorates is not what we want. What we want is some action on his part and on the part, or on the part of his offices, to say to Peru, enough is enough. You have violated international law, and we want you to give Lori Berenson a fair trial, a real trial, or release her.
Lori has said from day one she's innocent of the charges. All she asks for is a real trial in an open civilian court, Mario, so that you and every listener to this program could judge for him or herself what's going on there. Peru has hid behind the cloak of military court secrecy. They have refused to do anything but publish their propaganda through the press, both in Peru and here, and try to discredit Lori. But if they had any evidence, anything, they would be willing, shouldn't they be willing to show it to everybody? We're not afraid. Lori's never been afraid. What the hell is Peru afraid of showing the world what evidence it has against Lori? You know why? They have zippo, nothing. They have held her illegally for all this time while our government calls on the government of Peru to give Lori a trial. I say do more than call on the government of Peru, and if the president acts in accordance with Act 1732, he is obligated to do everything short of going to war. You know what that means, Mr. President? It means you must do what you do to Cuba. You must provide economic sanctions. You must freeze all Peruvian assets in this country. You must barricade and block the coasts. You must cut off all aid and all business aid to our ally, Peru, as you do in Cuba, as you do in Libya, as you do in Iraq and Iran and North Korea and other countries. That's what you're supposed to do, Mr. President, and I'd like to see you act. And that's what we have said. We want to, some people suggest that this is Operation Arouse the President, because we want him to proactively move forward now and help Lori. It's been 2.5 years. It's 920 days of incarceration in this 6x10 all concrete cell for 23 hours a day. And it's just wrong. Nobody in this world deserves a lack of such justice, and nobody, and I'm not saying because she's my daughter, I'm saying all the Peruvians there deserve justice and a real trial. And Lori has been discriminated against by Fujimori. He waived her passport. He has made a case of her for his own political agenda, which the United States is, I guess, supporting for his third illegal term as president in the year 2000. Regardless of that, the U.S. wants to have relations with Peru. It also has to abide by the law. Mr. Clinton, the law is on our side. You are obligated to carry it out. And I ask you, I urge you, and I tell you, Mr. President, I expect you to carry out that law. And I will be waiting to see how our message at MIT has gotten across to you, since you chose to speak at that campus and we chose to come up and confront you on this matter.
Mm-hmm. I think you pointed out a key thing there about the U.S. support for the Fujimori government, which is unfledgling and has been in a quite delicate situation in the past, but right now it has been quite supportive. And with that, in final words, what kind of support have you gotten within government circles in the United States, whether it's the Congress or even within the U.S. administration, about the case around Lori Berenson?
Well, certainly the Congress has been more and more supportive as time has gone on. The latest letter, which went to Madeleine Albright, telling her in December to do everything in her power to get Lori Berenson a fair trial, that letter was signed by 180 members of the House of Representatives and 55 senators. So that's a large chunk, very large chunk of the Congress that is pushing to get this settled in the way that we want, that looking for justice for Lori Berenson. The State Department, as Mark said, tends to tell us, well, whenever the situation comes up that's appropriate for us to mention, we mention that Lori should have a fair trial. I don't know what any of that means. Waiting around for the right moment to come up sounds just like you're forgetting about it for extremely long periods of time. And we're hoping that through the Congress, through working directly on the president, that we will get a more action, not waiting around for Peru to maybe suggest something, but for us to go in there and say, this is what we want.
And certainly, Lori deserves justice. She has been denied justice. She's been deprived of her liberty. Our allegiance says it's liberty and justice for all. Lori certainly has not had that. It's all we can ask for. It's all she asked for, but she surely deserves it. And Mr. Clinton's got to act. We can't wait to sit around any longer. How often does he speak to President Fujimori? How often does he meet him? They met about a month and a half ago, in early April it was, in Santiago, Chile. I've seen films, the two of them arm in arm, hugging, talking, toasting on different occasions, but to the best of our knowledge, although thousands and thousands of postcards, letters, emails, faxes went to the White House saying, Mr. President, we want you to raise the issue with President Fujimori about Lori and Santiago. Apparently the time wasn't ripe. He didn't have the opportunity. Well, when then does he have the opportunity? As Lori sits there tonight in her cold cell, are we waiting for President Clinton to decide when that opportunity will come? I want you to act now, Mr. President, tonight, this minute. And it's time for him to hear that from me as a father to another father. He says he feels people's pain. Feel my pain, Mr. President. It's 2.5 years. Feel Lori's pain. Feel Rhoda's pain. Feel my other daughter Kathy's pain. Feel the pain of all Americans who care about justice and human rights instead of talking the talk. I want my president to act, and I want him to act now. Lori is an American. She deserves more than she's been getting in Peru. She deserves justice. If President Fujimori's daughter were arrested in Boston when she went to school for committing a murder or committing a robbery, she would have what we would consider a decent trial and have a chance. In Peru, that reciprocation was not granted our daughter, and our daughter is worth no more than Kiko Sofia Fujimori, and certainly no less than Kiko Sofia Fujimori. And I demand the same thing for my daughter in Peru that she would have received here in the United States under the same circumstances.
We've been speaking with Mark and Rhoda Berenson, two university professors and the parents of Lori Berenson, a North American journalist and activist currently serving a life sentence in Peru. And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean.
Tengo una mesa que me alimenta, que a veces tiene hasta de fiesta. Mas si tuviera solo una araña burlona en mi despensa, tendría la vergüenza. ¿A qué más? Tengo zapatos, tengo camisa, tengo sombrero, tengo hasta risa. Mas si tuviera en mi ropero solo las perchas vacías, la vergüenza tendría. ¿A qué más?
Last week on Our Americas, we reported on Occidental Petroleum's announcement that they were not going to explore for oil in the indigenous territory of Colombia's Uwa people. In a statement published in the Colombian daily newspaper El Tiempo, Occidental said that instead it would exploit an area about 6 hours away from the Uwa land in the oil-rich Samoré block in northeast Colombia. This plan supposedly amounted to an almost 80% decrease from the territory that Oxy was originally planning for when the Colombian government granted them a license to drill for oil in the region back in 1995. But Oxy made this announcement through the Colombian government without discussing the matter with the UWA leadership or the National Indigenous Organization of Colombia, the ONIC. According to the ONIC, the California-based oil giant is once again making bilateral agreements with the Colombian government without taking into account the concerns and the rights of the UWA people. ONIC's president, Abadio Green Stossel, was in the United States last week, and I asked him to respond to Oxy's latest announcement.
Mira, primeramente nos sorprendió enormemente esa noticia. Primero porque El INCONA hasta ahora no ha podido hacer una.
First of all, this news surprised us considerably. One, because the Agrarian Reform Institute of Colombia, INCORA, has not yet completed the demarcation of the entire UA territory, which we have now been asking for over 2 years. So now that OXI says it's going to respect the UA territory, we must ask the question, what territory are they talking about? Knowing that INCORA and the government have not been able to demarcate the entire UA territory. Secondly, we ask, how can they have these talks with the government with results published in the newspaper the next day without having any participation of the UA leadership and the indigenous people? So as long as there is no clarity over these issues, we're always going to have doubts about what we read in the paper. And I found out about it after the fact, on my trip here to Boston, after arriving here through the newspapers. So it turns out that when I return to Colombia, I'm going to have to sit down with the Agrarian Reform Institute, with the government, to find out what territory are they now talking about.
Abadio Green Stossel, a Kuna Indian from the border region between Panama and Colombia, says as far as the Onik is concerned, the Uwa people's struggles against Occidental Petroleum has not changed, despite the pronouncements made last week by OXI.
El caso está lo mismo como el año pasado.
The case remains the same as it was last year, when we agreed in May that we would sit down with various government ministers to discuss these issues with them. We had expected to meet with them for 2 full days of talks, but the ministers arrived and stayed with us for only 2 hours. After this meeting, we brought the case of the UWA before the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights of the OAS, urging them to come into the UWA territory to find out directly what was going on. They came into an outlying municipality near the territory, but they didn't go directly into the territory, arguing that it was a very dangerous area, a red zone of conflict. Then a special panel from Harvard, along with the OAS, released a very important report that contained a number of recommendations which we feel are very constructive. The report said that before any talks can begin about the future of the area, there should be a complete suspension of any and all activity of oil exploration in the Samore block. Also, that before any negotiation can take place, the government should formalize and make very clear the demarcation of the entire indigenous territory of the UWA people, and that the talks over the future of the area should not be negotiations between the UWA people and OXI, but a negotiation between the UWA leadership and the Colombian government. So naturally, we were surprised with OXI's announcement, because this is how we left it last year. And up to now, we have not met with the government in any way. And up to now, we've only been able to exchange views with the OAS Harvard Commission, but not with the Colombian government or OXI.
El conflicto no es el pueblo UA con la occidental, quedó bien claro, sino que es una discusión que debe hacer el gobierno y el pueblo UA.
As we've reported in previous editions of Our Americas, the struggle against OXI being waged by the UWA people is one of preventing the annihilation of a culture whose roots stem back to the pre-Columbian Chibcha nation. With a population numbering about 5,000, the UWA have held steadfast against any and all foreign incursions into their territory, whether manifested in the Colombian military, guerrillas, or paramilitary forces. And after witnessing a century of devastation of other indigenous communities, not only in Colombia but throughout the Americas, caused by oil exploration, the UWA threatened to commit mass suicide if OXI went ahead with its drilling plans in their territory. Abadia Green Stossel of the Onik says their concerns are well warranted, given the history of oil exploration in Colombia.
Mira, si nosotros comenzamos un poco rápidamente a hablar de la historia desde que entró la compañías petroleras.
If we were to talk quickly about the history of oil's impact on Colombia, we can begin with, for example, Barranca Bermeja, an area of intense conflict which began in the 1920s. It's been a tragic history. What we've had with oil exploration is the death of the people. In Barranca Bermeja, when the oil companies arrived, there lived the Yariquia people. Today, There is not one living Yariquié who can retell that history. If we look at the history of the Bari Indians, known as the Motilones in North Santander, where major oil exploitation has taken place, half of their territory has been usurped, and half of the population has been decimated. Today, the Baris are still struggling because they found more oil in their territories, a situation that has been brutal. If we look now at what's happening in the Caño Limón area, the Inus, the Macaguanes, the Ciguanes, all the other groups that are their direct descendants, today they're all on the brink of extinction because they have been subjugated by alcoholism, prostitution, drug addiction, after their best land had been stolen. The land was adjacent to the Arauca River, which when it was overflowing, filled all the savanna, creating natural lagoons where the indigenous people sustained themselves for years through fishing, where they grew their crops, where they raised their animals. Today, Oxy and Shell have over 15,000 hectares of land in which they sustain their oil fields in this area. Add to this the presence of thousands of soldiers of the army who are there to protect the oil rigs. If you consider all this, then you begin to see that when we talk about the exploitation of oil, when we talk about the arrival of the oil multinationals into these territories, we can say that there has been no dignity for human beings, for the treatment of people. The only thing they think about are the profits that they can reap, regardless of the cost. And this isn't even known to the Colombian people, because if we measure the amount of the exploitation over the years, one would imagine that the Colombian people are doing pretty well, given all the exploration that has occurred, all the natural resources that have been used up. But this is not the case. So it's ridiculous to hear the government ministers say that because of the UWA people, Colombia's progress is being thwarted. I ask, what progress are we talking about when all the oil exploitation that has occurred there has only brought more misery to the Colombian people, and all the supposed riches are never seen here in the communities but taken away to other countries? So this is why we say that the struggle of the UWA is not only a struggle for the UWA or for indigenous people, but for all the Colombian people, and indeed for the entire world, because what we're talking about is defending national sovereignty.
Abadio Green Stossel is the president of the National Indigenous Organization of Colombia, the ONIC. He was speaking with us from Boston, where he was attending a series of meetings with the Harvard Conciliation Commission that has been involved in trying to resolve the dispute with Occidental Petroleum. We'll have continuous updates on the UWA people's struggles against Occidental Petroleum as the situation unfolds. But again, regardless of Oxy's announcements in late May that they would suspend activities in the UWA territory, as long as they do so without consulting with the indigenous leadership, according to the ONIC, it is nothing more than a public relations move. And that's about all the time we have on today's program. How Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. Associate producers are Sarah Gill, Amy Standen, Walter Krakmal, and Laura Tarantini, with production assistance by Eddie Soto. If you have any questions or comments, you can send us an email at mmcompa@igc.org. That's mmcompa@igc.org. For Our Americas, I'm Mario Murillo. Thanks for listening, and stay strong.